You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 10th of July 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
There has been no penalty whatsoever. Time to move forward. Yes, it's time to move forward, but there has to be a price to pay.
U.S. Senator John McCain is among those yet to be convinced by Donald Trump's nothing-to-see-here approach to accusations of collusion with Russia, following fresh revelations about contact between the Kremlin and Trump's campaign. My guests Mary Dajewski and Robert Fox will be here to discuss that and the day's other top stories, including why would any sane city want to follow Hamburg in hosting a G20? As the Brexit process descends further into shambles, might more people start asking if Article 50 is definite? And what are we to make of Donald Trump's G20 slideshow? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Mary Dajewski, columnist for The Guardian and The Independent, and Robert Fox, defence editor of The Evening Standard. Welcome both. We will start tonight with the ceaselessly self-replenishing cornucopia that is the relationship between US President Donald Trump and Russia. Mere hours after Trump suggested, and then unsuggested, working with Russia to create a joint cybersecurity unit, it was revealed that the marginally less likable of his two adult sons, Donald Jr., had met during the campaign with Natalia Veselnitskaya, a Russian lawyer on the promise of information detrimental to rival candidate Hillary Clinton. The lawyer in question, Ms. Veselnitskaya, whose name I will get right if I say it often enough, Robert, is apparently quite well connected in Russian circles, to use the euphemism. The first question being, if you are working on a US presidential campaign and you get a call from a Russian lawyer known to have ties to the Kremlin who wants a meeting with you because they say they have compromising information on your opponent, how dumb do you need to be to take that meeting?
Particularly given the timing.
Indeed.
It was only a few days after Donald J. Trump Sr. was confirmed as the Republican candidate. They were sort of going into, as only Trump can and the Trump campaign, into overdrive floundering mode. And they were scraping around, I think, for absolutely anything. And it seems that they'd got no safety catch on the verbal or the cyber arsenal, that they just cast their net around. As you say, they appear to have got this call from the lady. Fat lot of good it appears to have done them, because apparently it turned out she didn't have very good information after
all. Well, we're taking Donald Trump Jr.'s word for that.
Yes. Well, that has still to be disclosed. I completely agree with you on that. But can we go back to the cast of characters and the usual suspects? Because
please,
it not only brings in Donald Jr., but it brings in Mr. Kushner, again, the son-in-law, who became rather
also
crucial.
Also present at the meeting.
And he's had other meetings. And the Trump team is now trying to make out he is less than crucial, or not so crucial as we were once led to believe. Excuse my convolution, because it's all convolution and language, to the whole Trump effort and foreign policy. And by the way, only a few months ago we were hearing he could deliver peace in the Middle East. Sorry, and there's one more, and I think he may turn out as important, or probably more important than the other two, and it's Paul Manafort. Paul Manafort, pal of Trump, had
also at the meeting.
Also at the meeting. And remember, he's got into really hot water, and absolutely in hot water, over his association with Viktor Yanukovych, the ousted pro-Putin president of Ukraine, for whom he had been a paid advisor, and for other members of this thing. It's looking mucky, it's looking murky, but in the murk there's no, sorry to mix the dreadful metaphors, there is no smoking gun as yet. But if I follow your drift of your question, it is a cumulative, this. It's when somebody really wants to pull the plug on Trump. I am not quite sure when it'll be. I suspect it'll be at one of the two electoral breaks, I think. It's either coming up to the midterm election, so it'll
next
be about
year,
this time yeah. next year, which I think is the nearest scenario. I've got a horrible feeling that the guy's going to run through, though, do his first term. And so it comes up when he comes up for re-election.
Donald Trump Jr. has attempted to wave this off by suggesting that, you know, as he, I paraphrase only slightly, like I'm the first person working on a campaign who ever took a meeting with somebody who thought they had information about their opponent. That is doubtless true, but there are surely limits, if not legal, then basically sensible ones. Stuart Stephen, a former Republican strategist, has made the point today that during the 2000 campaign, the Al Gore campaign was sent from some source or other George W. Bush's debate brief book in 2000, a priceless trove of intel, you would think. Al Gore's campaign called the FBI. That is surely the only proper response.
But you may remember on a very famous occasion, people not unassociated with the man up for re-election, Richard Milhouse Nixon, decided to do a bit of a break-in too. I agree with you. The first thing that you said, I think, it's actually more important at the moment than the legal issue. It is sheer common sense. Sheer common sense tells you you don't get into this kind of a relationship. And it's quite clear from G20, I think Trump's in a bit of a mess with Putin. He doesn't know what to do with him. I think Putin is also slightly puzzled by the Trump performance, but he quite clearly has the initiative and shows he will maintain the initiative. And we're coming to discuss that later on, I know, over things like Ukraine, but above all Syria. They're floundering, again, to come to that. I think we're going to need one or two more things, if I can put it like that, before this comes to the fore. But I do not know what the special prosecutor is up to, what he is thinking about all of this. There'll be a lot of heat, people will head for the beach, and then there'll be serious thought in the autumn, because then they've really got to start looking at the Trump record, you know, the debris of what he's left behind, breaking up the Trans-Pacific Partnership, breaking out of the Paris Accord on climate change, not delivering on draining the swamp, and above all, relaunching industry, giving jobs back to the blue-collar workers, whether those that were on the site of Bethlehem Steel in Pennsylvania or in the coal mines of the Appalachians. And I think it's that record. And that's where he is safe so far, that he can still, he's still got sort of support in flyover America, the middle states. But I can't believe reading the general, you know, the general disquisition. And I support my old friend, our late great friend, Marys and mine, Rupert Cornwell. One of the last and one of his finest pieces about Trump was actually how MSM, mainstream media, is doing the business. And looking today at the New York Times and the Washington Post, they are delivering on this and they'll keep going. And I think they're much more dangerous than any special prosecutor.
Just a final thought on this subject, Mary. We're going to talk more about the G20 shortly, but one of the other interesting highlights of the G20 was Donald Trump's abrupt invention and very abrupt abolition of a joint US-Russian cybersecurity enterprise. He allowed just enough time for people to make all the jokes about how this is like George W. Bush in September 2000. And one establishing a joint counterterrorism command with Al-Qaeda, which was very kind of him in a way. But what did you make of that? Is this just yet another case of Donald Trump just saying things that come into his head? Is it even imaginable that US and Russia could work together on this?
Well, I sort of think that there's been a plan along those lines for quite a long time. And there was something vaguely that was in the air, even in Obama's presidency. So I didn't think it was... The problem is that it takes on a whole new complexion because of all the allegations about hacking. Now, you can actually... You could make a case for saying, you know, as all the computer companies and security companies hire bright young things who know how to hack, say, the FBI or the CIA, you know, the Russians are exactly the guys. They're exactly the guys that you want to be doing business with to find out about these things. And I think it would also be wrong to say that the Russians aren't worried about their own systems being hacked. I mean,
well,
they
could in turn hire North Koreans.
Well, I think they might have a few inhibitions about that, not because they're worried about security, but they have a rather superior attitude towards North Korea, I think.
Well, let us move seamlessly along to the G20 itself, which Donald Trump declared a great success, as he generally does things which involve himself. But was it? Specifically, was it a great success for the host city, Hamburg, which now faces a lengthy and expensive cleanup following large and often violent protests, to say nothing of the medical bills and sick leave for more than 500 injured police officers? There have been calls in some quarters for the resignation of Hamburg's mayor, Olaf Scholz. Mary, first of all, Hamburg has obviously a significant and indeed proud history of dissent and radical protest, etc., etc. Was holding the G20 in Hamburg a dumb idea to begin with?
Well, when you look at it, it has to be said that maybe it wasn't the most sensible place to have it, simply from the security perspective. You understand that it's become sort of fashionable to hold these meetings in places that aren't the national capital. But in the past, they've tended to make them in places that are relatively easily fortified because of the of difficulties and whole cities being brought to a halt in the past. So it is slightly strange that they decided to put it in Hamburg, not only because of the sort of political complexion of the city, but that at least before the capital moved to Berlin, and still to an extent, Hamburg is an enormous media centre in Germany. And you would have thought that in some ways, sort of the further from the mainstream media to hold this sort of meeting, the better. So everything was set up, really, for this sort of confrontation. But, you know, even if... You know, I have a sort of a reasonably respectful view of German police and policing, that they sort of know how to do it. They're superbly professional and everything. But in this case, I mean, it just seems to have fallen to pieces. And they were talking on the second day that they've got 200 police injured. Now, you know, I don't know what the definition of injured is. But even if you take it as somebody got hit by some projectile, and that's the least of it, it still seems, I mean, an appallingly botched operation to go that badly wrong.
Things had been noticeably quieter in the previous host city, Hangzhou, funnily enough. Robert, why did it get so bad on this occasion? Was it just that it was Donald Trump's first G20?
I think Mary's really got something in it. There are cities with great radical traditions. And it is amazing, because I was just thinking of this, I'm thinking back quite a number of years now to Genoa, where they had a similar scene. And Genoa is a very proud, radical city.
At which one protester was famously killed.
Yes, indeed. And the police behaved very badly. They overreacted because they put the carabinieri in. But it was a city, it was the city of the Red Brigades. It was a city that had liberated itself rather than waiting for the Allies at the end of the Second World War. And you've got the cocktail of the times being out of joint, and I absolutely agree. They must have known that, particularly with the media presence, that Hamburg was a target city. There is this thing, it hasn't been so bad in recent times, in recent memory. Maybe we'll get away with it. I see and hear an awful lot of that, even down to the level. I was at a City of London counter-terrorism conference breakfast meeting the other day. I'm sorry, Andrew, the level of complacency is still at times eye-watering about these things, about doing, as Mary was suggesting, basic security. What you do, you cordon things off, you make sure. The whole point is not have a punch-up, it's to avoid it, it's to park things before that. And they seem just not to have been prepared for this.
I mean, Mary, do the organisers of the G20 and similar summits have to give up on having them in major cities in democracies, or should they just have them in capital cities, as you point out, where there are perhaps more detailed protocols, more resources you can deploy? I mean, when the G20 was held in London in 2009, there was an amount of protest and there was an amount of trouble, but nothing like the scale we've seen in Hamburg.
I mean, I think a lot of capital cities have got it down in a way to an art of separating various zones and having zones which you write off to protest and zones which are extremely securitized. You know, you see it at British party conferences, and they've got it down to, they've really got this stuff professionally organised. The G7, G8, to an extent, they've given up on that. And they're now holding it in sort of castles and islands and places that you can actually cordon off completely.
Well, there have been suggestions of a single permanent venue for the G20 and or it being held somewhere like, you know, one of the Azores, for example, which you could completely rope off. But, Robert, is it important, especially when you have an extraordinary gathering like the leaders of the G20, should protesters should it be a point of principle that protesters can get within earshot, that they can literally be heard?
I think you're in a very, very delicate question now, because that we have, particularly with the right-wing conservative press in the Anglo-Saxon world, you know, that really populism is abroad and this is absolutely terrible, and the shutting down of protest. It would be absolutely terrible if they did that. I can see it happening, because what they will feed into
when it's held in Riyadh, 3 G20s from now.
Yes, that's going to be great. But, you know, sorry, I was about to make, I think, a semi-serious point. What they do is they're beginning to feed in the counter-terrorist narrative, saying, oh, it'd be terrible if this happened, therefore we're going to shut the whole thing down. And I think that that's appalling. Oddly, I was just thinking, why places like the City of London, which has been blown up, people forget when there was the attack on the minarets and so on, they did a heck of a lot of damage, the IRA. They did learn that lesson, and you can shut things off. But actually the street protest, which I suspect we're going to see quite a lot of in the UK over the next 2 years, not just because of Brexit, but as long as Mrs. May hangs on, and it's also a chosen method and a well-worn method of the opposition, it's going to be interesting to see how the opinion formers say, oh, it's a very bad thing to protest at all. I think it's a very healthy thing, because it's actually people shouting things, people who are identifiable, rather than going in for multiple identity on Twitter and Facebook.
Well, there is, of course, always the Huangzhou solution, where the city authorities declared a week's holiday and encouraged everybody to leave while the G20 was on. We are going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Mary Dejewski and Robert Fox. Coming up next, might Brexit have a reverse gear?
Summer is officially here, and so is Monocle's bumper July-August double issue. Here we celebrate quality of life and reveal this year's rundown of the top 25 cities to live in worldwide. We also meet the people striving to make life in their cities better, from the mayor of Los Angeles to the sunny team that looks after Tokyo's parks and gardens, to the urban heroes giving back to their hometowns. Meanwhile, in design, we cast our gaze up to the rooftops in Milan and find a hidden and surprisingly verdant world above the fray. And of course, we've always got room for a bit of pure hedonism as we dance the night away in Tel Aviv, unwind in Finland's most inviting and steamiest company retreats, and tuck into some sun-kissed beach food in Valencia. And speaking of sun-kissed, we also sit down with Mario Testino for his hypothetical last meal. That's all in the July-August issue of Monocle, on newsstands everywhere now. Or head to monocle.com to become a subscriber.
You are listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Mary Dejewski and Robert Fox. And let's look now at the UK, where there are increasing indications that the Leave campaign, which last year persuaded 52% of British voters of the wisdom of exiting the EU, is reaching that self-destroying phase common among dogmatic revolutionary movements throughout history. Dominic Cummings, who was campaign director of Vote Leave, has described government officials seeking to extend the concept of Brexit to the nuclear power market at Euratom as morons, and has further lambasted the truckload of crap ideas, these are direct quotes, of which the exit process to date has been constituted. Robert, especially following last month's excitingly inconclusive general election, do we sense a certain measure of rethink in the air among the British public?
I think, to take the Dominic Cummings thing, and I won't to lower myself, to base myself to a vulgarity, crap and so on, a hell of a lot is being shoveled into the too difficult box. There's a general or a spreading realisation that it can't be done in time. If you give yourself a two-year deadline, March 2019, under Article 50. By the way, we haven't really got into the arch theological exegesis of what Article 50 really means or doesn't mean. One who was involved, he claims to be the complete architect, but he wasn't, Lord Kerr, former head of the British Foreign Office, says, it's unfinished business itself, and it can be reversed. Your point, which you made very well, if I may say so, is the more extreme you come in your position, which is what the Leavers are saying, they're practically going to declare Article 50 says that the Earth is flat. And I think that this is driving public officials complete on both sides, both for the EU and the UK, completely nuts. This is not Fox just muttering it out of thing. I was at a meeting of great luminaries. We came to hear a wonderful piece of rhetoric from former Secretary of State John Kerry at Ditchley Park, a big think tank, pointy-headed place in Oxfordshire. I did a general straw poll of people, and sorry, in sum, they say it ain't going to be done in time. It may not be done at all. And it's not just politicians that are saying that.
No. It is sometimes almost as if none of these people actually thought this thing through because they didn't actually think they would actually win and they just enjoyed playing the sanctimonious martyr so they could get on television. Mary, recent Servation poll said 54% of the British public is now tending in a Remainward direction. This is the difficulty with the will of the people, of course. It changes. Where would those polls need to get to for any sane government to start trying to find a way out of this?
I think they'd have to go way above 60%, maybe even towards 70%, because I think the fury, what we haven't really talked about is the fury of the Brexit voters if a U-turn happens, even a U-turn to the point of a semi-U-turn, which would say a Norwegian option or a Swiss option, that does not include, does not provide for strict controls on people who come into the country, whether to work or to visit or join families. That was a crucial point of the people voting to leave the European Union. And it was cast under this business of taking back control, sovereignty, however you point it out. And if you go for anything less than a complete, you know, what they call a hard Brexit, you're not going to get that. And then you're going to get people out into the, in the streets. You know, we're talking about street protests. I think we've seen nothing yet. And I'm not sure whether it is reversible, not in the sense of obviously it's reversible by, you know, the people that we now call the elites and the politicians and all the rest of it. But I think without a new general election that is fought specifically on the matter of staying or leaving, or a new referendum which outdates the previous one, I think it is absolutely impossible, because you have this question of the referendum, quote, the will of the people, and however much Parliament may squirm, it has said we accept the will of the people, and unless you have the reverse expressed in some equivalent, equally formal way, it's not going to be possible.
Robert, if those poll numbers did start getting to where Mary was suggesting, and it was consistent, and it became apparent that there was a large-scale rethink in the air, and there is, of course, also the brute demographic reality that Leave voters die, I think somebody pointed out, an average of about 600 a day, and that many potential Remain voters come online, that the demographic breakdown at the last general election about what young people think about the EU versus old people is, I mean, that is all one-way traffic. Is an exit or a reverse of Article 50 or a swerve around the hard Brexit more likely to be achievable by a Conservative government, though, led perhaps by a repentant Brexiteer? And I can just about imagine Boris Johnson being shameless enough to pull this off.
Sorry, he's had it. I know Boris very well. I look at his performance. He's been absolutely appalling in the last few weeks. He just can't get his act together. So don't look for some sort of populist Saul converting to St. Paul, having a Damascene conversion on this. And this is where it's very interesting how I agree with an awful lot of what Mary has said, but I absolutely disagree fundamentally, because I think it was a trick. It was like the famous Mussolini legge truffa, the fact that 2.5% of the vote
not of the possible electorate, or less, decided that it was going that way. And then you say, which is where I think the parliamentarians, all of them, are very culpable in the UK to say it cannot be reversed. Look, for goodness sake, ever since we've had statutes in Parliament, which I don't want to give you a history lesson, but they really begin with Magna Carta and the Charter of the Forest in the 13th century, everything, including the monarchy, has been reversible. And the fact is that this thing isn't working. But where I agree with Mary, it's not going to be done in time, and it will have to go. It will go into a general election. And by the way, if they carry on in the way that they do, long predicted, I think de facto, if not de jure, the Conservative Party is going to break up. And they, because they're not going to be able to campaign with one voice, if it's on whether staying or going with the EU. So happy days, as you say, as Mary is absolutely right, shambles ahead.
Well, finally tonight, though this does lose a great deal without the visual accompaniment. Plenty more where that came from as well. That was the soundtrack to a slideshow of highlights of Donald Trump's visit to the G20, released yesterday on the president's Twitter feed, because this is the kind of thing that just happens now. The images are meticulously curated to give every impression that he certainly isn't a risibly overpromoted game show host floundering several miles out of his depth, intercut with a somewhat disturbing number of pictures of his daughter Ivanka, who was also there for some reason. Mary, did this... I don't even know what to call it.
How about promotional video?
If you like. Words are actually failing me.
An advertorial.
Fine, either's good. Did it cause you to reassess your opinion of Donald Trump at all?
No, it didn't. But I think I doubt whether it would cause anybody completely to reassess their view of Donald Trump. But I think it might have sort of, for the believers, it could reinforce their belief. It's not going to convert the disbelievers.
Well, I mean, one would assume that's the case. It's very hard to imagine anybody who was again Trump casting their eyes and ears upon this nonsense and thinking, oh, well, now that I now see it completely differently. But, I mean... Robert, who are the people who this is for? Who is listening and watching this and just thinking, yeah, this isn't mad?
It's just Newsack. I really wanted Zero Mostel, as in the producers, Harpo Marx, as in Duck Soup, to come on and just to add in. This is so risible. But it is symptomatic for any but the converted, and I agree with Mary about that. This is the withdrawal of America. The analogy after G20, sorry, the wonderful Financial Times, had a very good, the takeaways. This is Woodrow Wilson failing to make America really international, as he promised at Versailles in 1919. This is the really campaign song of American withdrawal.
But it also, I mean, just to come sort of full circle to where Robert was starting, this is for flyover territory.
Yeah.
This is for the people who voted Trump into office. This is the reinforcement, the reassurance, our guy is doing what he's supposed to do. He's cutting a figure in the world and he's bringing it back home. Yes, it's withdrawal to an extent of the US from the world.
Getting
but
back
I think
into the Alamo.
Maybe we're going to have to get used to that.
Yep. Well, how did you rate it, Mary, as an exercise in propaganda in its own right? There was something of it, of the sort of those sort of luxuriant portraits of Stalin beaming at fields full of tractors. Not that you grow field tractors in fields. You know what I'm saying? It was quite odd. It was it's the big man theory, isn't it?
It's Mussolini, actually. Very. I mean, because it's my period. Look at the antecedents of what happened post-war in Italy. It's like the Guerra del Grano, the fight for grain, this famous thing, this chest beating. Even the music was like this.
But in a way, we thought that those years had passed.
I agree.
That was an age, a certain age that is gone and that we know better now. And now we see, actually, it's coming back. You know, we see it not just in the US, we see Turkey, we see to an extent Russia. And there is the cult of the big man and lording it over the people who are adoring him.
And we should probably therefore say all that stuff while we still can. That does bring us to the end of today's show. Mary Dajewski and Robert Fox, thanks very much for joining us. The show was produced by Ben Ryland and researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. More music next at 1900. It's Culture with Robert Bound, and there'll be more in the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. I'm back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. Actually, now that I think of it, no, I'm not, someone else's. I'm back on Wednesday. For now, I'm definitely Andrew Miller. Thanks very much for listening. Goodbye. Tomorrow's show will be great, however.